What's up? Welcome, welcome. Episode 32 Wrecked Radio. How are we doing, gents?
Good, thanks. Real questions, how are you doing?
I'm feeling a little under the weather. That the Vegas flu. I made it back in time for the show, though. Somebody put the line at like plus 200. They would have lost. The cash pick if you bet against it. But yeah, here I am feeling. I felt better. But anyway, let's get into the sponsor of our show.
Yeah, hey guys, as you know, this show is sponsored by Rollbit, one of the largest crypto casinos out there. You can do everything from sports betting, casino games, NFT lending, NFT gambling, pretty much anything DGEN related, crypto futures. Check out rollbit.com or rollbot.com depending on your jurisdiction. We will have a loot box spin at the end, and as usual we have two codes to give away. The first code is Zeneca 8582, and if you guys want to watch this on video stream, check out the YouTube link that's in the pinned tweet, and I put the code on the YouTube stream as well.
Yeah, don't do the video though. I don't want anyone looking at me right now. I'm wearing the Pepe dunce cap, the shame Pepe hat that looks all funny, but you know. Here we are. So yeah.
What happened? You looked. I was following you for those few days. It felt like it was you heading to the winner's table.
Yeah.
Right?
No. It was only day three, but no. I mean, I was playing super well, feeling great. My tables were so easy. I had like 480,000 chips, which was probably around 230 or 240 big blinds at the time. Raise under the gun plus one with kings, small blind. Like some reg chick, she just like, you know, she three bet to like 3.5x, 4x. And then this dude who had just sat at the table, who was other raises, he just was like raising 5 to 6x pot, like constantly. Or no, 5-6x big blind preflop constantly. And he was just kind of being real weird and sporadic. He just instantly made it 200,000, which was a pretty large raise. I shoved and he just snap called without even asking for a count. And he had like 220 big blinds too, so. It was pretty insane. He had just had ace queen and he won. So yeah, I don't know. Story's not that crazy, but it was definitely like a suicide play by him. But hey, you know, he got rewarded and the gods frowned upon me. So
then what happened?
Did you just I went and gambled and stuff, you know. What?
So did you descend into a Vegas hell? Like what
No, I mean, I wasn't even like, I didn't go that hard this trip actually. I just like the time change is just a lot going back and forth, and then
yeah.
I mean, I actually won money gambling in baccarat and blackjack. So I don't know. I made money on a trip, but still, you know, it's a blessing that I made it to the show, though. Just for you guys.
Next year.
Yeah.
Who's going forward? Any well-known players do well?
I don't know. I didn't really like. I haven't been keeping like that much track of it because I really don't care at this point. But I don't know. I know Chance Cornuth was pretty far, but he's just busted. So. It doesn't really seem like none of my friends are in it right now. So,
it's what it is. Anyway. Tournament poker. You never know.
Yeah. Then what else do we got? What have you guys been doing this week?
I don't know, man. We got bigger into Pepe. We've been buying some shit coins. I've just been adding on dips to the long, but man, just can't break out.
Just chopping away.
Can't break out. Yeah,
it's chopped my life. My life's been chopped again. Can't help myself apparently from flipping and going for like continuation momentum, and it just doesn't happen ever. So that's been depressing. But you know, it's time to chill out. I'm going to Asia next month, so I'm thinking I don't trade till after next month.
Oh, nice.
That might be the play.
Where are you going?
Tokyo and then Indonesia with actually Fon Ro, you know, the guy from 65.
Yeah,
we've never met before, but yeah, he's like, you want to go scuba diving in Indonesia? I was like, fuck it.
Well, and Bali or like
no, like Komodo. We're doing Komodo and Bima. So should be seeing some sharks, whale sharks, a lot of cool shit, and doing a hike on Komodo to see dragons and stuff. So that'll be fun. It's a board. You live aboard a liverboard yacht for 8 days. So we'll see how it goes.
That's going to be awesome.
Looks like I'll be doing the show from there.
Yeah, of course.
anyway, so yeah. So do you want to get into Zeneca, who's our guest today?
Yeah.
Somebody want to do an intro for Zeneca over here?
Yeah, why not? I mean, Zeneca's was kind of started when I think all of us probably started. Like
early 21
vibes? Yeah.
Early 21, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like I remember coming in, you were a Bored Ape. I mean, I remember you from doing the floor prices. You were the original floor price guy.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
OpenSea didn't even have floors.
He had like the detailed dashboard Excel sheets over here.
Yeah, yep. And they were like infinitely useful. So like this is the time I was also doing like a little news thing roundup, and he would do like this floor price. I used to love it. And then as always, you come in, you get hooked, you then seem to become a bit of a guru slash leader in the space, and that's kind of spiraled into you having your own businesses. But before that, you were a professional poker player too, right?
I played poker for 15 years. Yeah, nice. 2005 to 2021. So listening to the poker talk, I haven't played the World Series in like, I don't know, 6-7 years, but I miss it. It's so much fun.
Yeah, it's fun when you go deep, right? But then it's not fun when you like 20 poker.
It's torture. Like tournament poker is torture. It's like, it's fun unless you win, you hate yourself. So
yeah. I tried to play another one right after busting and just was like, what am I doing? I can't do this. Just instantly shipped it. Anyway, get back to you.
Yeah, I mean, that was my intro for you, but maybe, did I miss anything? And maybe we should start with the poker history. There were a few poker players like, no, trading in the early days, KBM yourself. I feel like we've had a few of them on
or anything. But...
Yeah, everyone seemed to have a history in poker. How did you get into the space, and maybe before that as well?
I got into poker in 2005. Just I was in high school and like playing with friends because it was on TV everywhere and it was hard to miss. And then I have this really obsessive, addictive personality. I'm very competitive as well. So like I saw it and I was like, my friends are like, I'll just casually play. Meanwhile, I'm online, like going all the poker forums and like researching strategy and getting booked. And then I figured you can play online. And then I was like, well, this is amazing. And you can actually, it was 2005. So the games were super soft and I was able to make way more money doing than anything else I could do in my life. So that's that like hooked me in, and I like dropped out of university and just kept playing online poker. All the way up to like 2021. And so I had some friends that were like, I mean, poker players get into crypto very easily. I think there's a lot of natural overlap. And so in 2017, they sort of brought me in and I was like, oh yeah, this is cool. And I just saw it as another way to like gamble basically and speculate and try and make money. So that when the bear market hit, I was like, oh, well, that was a fun experiment. Let's go back to poker. But it wasn't until 2021 that I came back and I saw that, oh, there's actually, you can do stuff now. There's like DeFi and there's these NFT things. And that's when I was like, huh, I guess crypto is here to stay. And then I like fell fully down the rabbit hole. I think like all of us in early 21, I was like, oh yeah, this is my place.
Yeah, I think that was kind of the same for us, that we were in TradFi and we kind of just felt like there was more upside. Like when stuff was doing like 10Xs, it just felt like you should spend more time focused on it. But then were you doing, I mean, I remember you doing some trading back then, but you kind of rolled into, I don't know, other aspects pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Did you have any big wins? I know you bought Bored Apes obviously because
you got like Uplocks is the thing. Like very early on, I got into Uplocks and have just been like was obsessed. Still am obsessed. I think that's like to me it's just like the clearest bull case for NFTs is generative art, or one of the clearest bull cases. So that 2021 summer August was just the craziest time of my life. Just like, I mean, for many things, like Uplocks especially, it was like there was a bull run and then there was an Uplocks bull run that made the other bull run look like nothing. And so just sort of, trading a lot. Like I spent most of 2021 trading and then sort of pivoted into like business and content and all this like kind of other stuff that's less fun, but definitely interesting and less sort of heart attack inducing. So Uplocks is a big one for me.
I think did you monetize it? Did you manage to get out of things, or did you diamond hand it all?
I mean, I diamond hand way more than I should have, but I took out enough. So like, it's, right, okay, yeah, it's you and can have so much regret. There's always you could always do better. But you know, if I think of where I was at the start of 2021 compared to where I am now, it's like I would never in a million years imagined I'd make that amount of money or anything like that.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking about it. Like this space can really beat you up if you hold on to that sort of stuff.
If you let it, yeah.
Yeah. So how did you first think about NFTs when you first came into it? Like,
I thought they were an edge
from poker, or how did you transfer those sort of skills?
Well, so like my first reaction was like NFTs are a scam. I think everyone has that. And then once it got into like the whole trading aspect, I felt like there were just like basic fundamental things that you learn in poker that a lot of the people in the NFT space didn't necessarily know. Things like implied odds, like, oh yeah, you buy something, you mint something, and okay, 80% of the time it's going to be a scam, but 20% of the time it's going to 50x. It's like, oh yeah, I'm just going to mint as many of those as I can. And like that just statistical thinking is, I think, what really helped through that massive bull run. And it really was a case for like, I probably say like a few months where it's like, you just mint anything you can possibly mint because yes, a bunch of it's going to go to zero. But even then, like it would pump first and then go to zero. So you'd be able to get out with like what you put in. But then there's like the occasional things that goes absolutely crazy. So yeah, the poker mindset in general, I think is one of the better ones for crypto and just life in general, just thinking of things through like a logical, statistical sense.
Were you still playing poker at the start? Were you still like one foot in, one foot out?
For like a very brief amount of time, for like a month. But like, I actually remember this like pivotal moment where I just have to go all into crypto. Like this is where the big opportunity is. And I did kind of compare it to like 20, cause I was like beating myself up. Like what, I was here in 2017 and 2018. And why did I leave? I could have been buying ETH at, you know, $100 and 80, like that kind of mindset. So like this time I'm not going to make the same mistake. I'm just going to forget poker. And I was already kind of over poker after 15 years. It's a grind and it's not the most fun thing to do day in, day out. So yeah, I pretty quickly just dropped poker completely and went into the space.
When you were when you were buying stuff in 2021, what was the thing that you minted, or like the first thing that you bought where you had that big return on, the way you were like, shit, I've just got to like drop everything that I'm doing right now and just go all into this. Like, what was that?
It was Zedron. So in the early days of Zedron, it was the worst minting experience ever, because it was on Polygon and you had to bridge, and then the website went down and it was buggy. But if you were able to mint, which I figured out like some refresh hack on the website where if you like pull, like you can just click a button and like, be able to mint. And I got like 5 or 6 horses, and it was like an instant like 7x. And that was when I was like, oh yeah, this is different, and this is where I need to just go all in. And actually one of my horses was like a good racer. And so like I decided to race it, and was just, I spent like the entire month of April waking up, entering my horse into races. And I made like 3 or 4 ETH in the month, which was like a good amount of money for me at the time. And I was like, oh, I'm just a digital horse racer now. It's fun. Yeah.
It is funny that I remember those early days. I remember I spoke to a DC investor who just thought it was like, I'm a digital, you know, landowner now. Like you suddenly just like reimagine yourself as like some traditional job, but on the internet. Yeah. It was a weird time. It was a weird time.
Yeah. What about you guys? What were like your first NFTs? How'd you get in? Yeah. I'd love to know more.
I think the first stuff that we started buying was like one of ones on Super Rare. I think when we first looked at NFTs, I think we really believed in the use case of it being a medium for art and like breaking down some frictions of like, at the time, like royalties get paid, you know, easily on chain. You don't have this idea of like storage costs or transportation costs, and this idea of like people spending more time online or the metaverse and having like digital art to display. So I think it was really just like an extension of the art market, but in this format. And because it was right at the beginning of the movement, or maybe 2 or 3 years in, you had the opportunity to buy things that would like be historic or be cultural, etc. And we were actually like really skeptical in the PFP stuff to begin with. I remember like we hated punks. We just thought there was like all these guys are running around like shilling them. Didn't touch any of the PFP stuff, and it wasn't until like, you know, I minted a bunch of Bored Apes, and that was like the first win for me. And then we started from then on, you started seeing these like communities and cliques form around like profile picture projects, which then kind of like it wasn't until that that I really realized like the power of that. And I know like PFPs aren't the range anymore, but you still can't deny like this idea of digital identity and this idea of like people congregate together in communities and stuff. But we kind of came in from like the Super Rare one of one stuff, and then eventually moved into the PFP stuff, and eventually just like moved into everything really. But it was it was never something I thought I would end up doing full time. It's like so someone tells you about it, and on the side you're like, cool, like I'll just buy the, you know, throw a few grand on this to see if I can like make a few grand more and see what happens. Basically, I just never really thought
we had full-time jobs. Like we would work from like, I don't know, like we'd wake up 6 a.m., go to work at 7. We were traders. So like, then we would finish at like 6, 7 p.m. And then we just, I'd end up doing like my Twitter thread on like the news at like 7 p.m. each day. Ovi actually took some time off for 3 months. But then, you were also trading like while you had a job for a lot of it.
Yeah, it was that. It's that moment in time where I was like, I should be doing my job. And I'm just like on like MetaMask mobile trying to fucking like.
Just like outbidding like, me and shit and pumping hard up like an asshole.
It was like.
Like we were both just going back and forth.
But it was back in the day when you couldn't, there was no like blur or like aggregation tools. So if you wanted to like, say you like minted 100 of a project and you wanted to sell 100 of them, you had to list each one individually.
Such a pain.
It was,
I blame, like that's why I've bagheld so much. I was like, it was just so annoying to have to list, and I was like,
it was a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I mean, I started with hash masks personally. Where
those are cool.
Yeah, somebody messaged me like the day as the mint was like happening, and was like, yeah, you just mint these things and they reveal, and I was like, oh, cool. I like collecting shit and gambling on reveals and whatnot and trying to get something rare. So I minted some, and then somebody had to buy the last hash mask for 100 ETH.
Oh,
for everything
right.
to reveal, and
that.
I ripped it in because I was like, I want him to reveal. Let's run, let's go. And apparently, I was pretty reckless with ETH back then. And that's how I got started there. And then me and some guy made some algo to like find the traits and shit. I don't know, it was crazy.
That's wild. But that the ultimate like bonding curve thing.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. The bonding curve.
Bonding curve.
I think the Pranksy's like fucking CryptoPunk raffle was the other exposure I got. Yeah. You buy the raffle ticket. I think I got punks for like 5 ETH. Only did one. Sold it for like 10. And then didn't get back in for a while.
Oh, man.
Good old days.
So many ways to make money back then. Like,
for real.
So independent from each other.
Wake up and mint base you and OV text me. I was like, I'm not getting out of bed for this. Maybe tomorrow. Nope. Didn't do it. Unfortunate.
I didn't mint them because I had like a group chat with my poker friends, and like the day after when they started taking off, one of our friends was like, oh shit, sorry guys, I saw these at like 4 a.m. and I minted them, but then I fell asleep and I didn't tell you guys, and it was like, it didn't take off.
Well, Steph even told me at least, but I went to bed instead. Yeah.
I remember that conversation so clearly. Like it was like 4 a.m. or something like that, and when I was living in NYC at the time. Just like I think I texted like 5 or 6 people. I texted KBM, texted Mando, texted my brother-in-law, a couple other guys. No one bought them. And to be fair, I was really drunk and I just quit my job, so everyone was like,
"Please buy these."
He's not thinking straight.
Like, you cannot trust my texts were like, "Mate, just go to bed." Like,
you sound crazy, buddy.
Like 50 grand, fucking minting something, and I was like, "What are you doing?" And he was like, "Nah, man." I was like, "All right, I'll speak to you in the morning."
Oh my god!
Yeah, it was,
fumbled the bag.
Yeah.
God, how life would have been different. How life would have been different.
Probably would have got a fucking Bored Ape. What is it called? Honorary. Life would have been different. I could have been so cool.
No, you just like to hate the apes. Were you really happy when the apes just crashed? The timeline was amazing.
Hilarious.
He still is. That's about 50% of KBM's post.
It's either Rollbit or that. That's all I have left.
Do you still trade? Or like, I mean, we made the call like in 2022. We were like, you know what, I think we weren't going to trade as much. We were just going to be project builders. But then we still had a portfolio, and we obviously exited some apes earlier this year. But are you still in the trading game, or are you now like fully in the builder /
more in the building side of things? Like I enjoy, it's so much work. It's gotten so much harder as well. Like obviously trading is PvP, and like the quality of like the traders has increased exponentially, and the opportunities has like diminished. So it's like you have to work 10 times as hard to find a tenth of the opportunity. And it's like I made that call probably 2022 as well, or late 2021 even, where I was like, I could keep doing this, but I saw the writing on the wall where it's like, all right, it's already getting more difficult. And it's similar to poker, where in the early days of poker, it was like anyone could, you know, just flip up a hand chart and you can make money easily. With NFTs and crypto, is like, well, yeah, it's great now, but like it's gonna get worse really, really quickly. And I wanted to focus on building and my own projects and that kind of stuff. And that's kind of where I'm spending most of my time. I really don't trade at all anymore.
So what are you bullish on there? Like what are the things that you think see in this space which look undervalued still? Or what if you were to put on their hat? Is it more just being an entrepreneur, or where do you see the paths of value like building out over the next few years?
I think that there are like certain NFTs and categories of NFTs that are still probably going to well outperform other asset classes. And I think that's probably, it's not like a category. It's not like PFP. It's not generative art, but it's like, let's say within generative art, you look at like squiggles, autoglyphs. There's like Fidenzas, the top, it's like the 80-20 rule, like 20% of the premium generative art collections, I think will do exceptionally well long-term. But as like an asset class, I think generative art is going to be around and do great. But like just buying a random piece of generative art right now is no better than buying, well, maybe slightly better than buying a random PFP. Of the PFPs, I think that, again, as we all know, 99.99% go to zero and not be around. I believe in this digital social identity thing. I think there's power to it. And I think that it's like this massive experiment and companies are trying to figure out how to incorporate like holders and owners and a business model in a way that makes sense. And I think that there's probably a handful of those that will survive and perform really well long-term. But if I had to pick one, it's like, for me, it's like generative art. Again, it's just all comes back to like Art Blocks specifically, but a few other collections that aren't part of Art Blocks. And I think those will do very well long-term because they're like inherently crypto native in a way that a lot of other things aren't.
I think generative art's interesting. It's like at the beginning that for all the wins and losses of that we had in 2021, Art Blocks is something that we just completely didn't touch and missed, despite actually entering the whole NFT space because of art in the first place. And it took me a while to just get my head around that. But I do think, like, I agree with you. I do think, and by the way, like, generative art's massive. Like, there's like, you know, Art Blocks mint at very frequent intervals, and it's difficult to say, like, yeah, all of it is going high. And I view, like, you have to buy, like, the right things within Art Blocks, mm-hmm, I think.
Yeah.
You know, buy art that you like, but just from the return standpoint.
Yeah.
But I do think, you know, like, if you're the question that I think you get asked by a lot of normal people is like, why would I buy an NFT rather than buying a print? And mm-hmm, when you think about generative art and when you think about AI art and we think about animated art to an extent, there are real reasons why it has to be an NFT, because like, mm-hmm, you're appreciating something from like a code-driven standpoint. You appreciate something that like cannot physically exist, yeah, in the form of a print or a painting, right? So that's why I think, like, you know, stuff like Art Blocks, like, well, this just makes so much sense because it's actually using blockchain technology to, yeah, create a piece of art that is the narrative that is like current in our time and can be appreciated not just from like an aesthetic standpoint. And I know like a lot of people may be like, oh, this looks like shit or whatever. They might look at something like this. I don't really like the way this looks or whatever. Yeah. But the beauty of it is sometimes in how it was created and in the code, etc. I think that's what, yeah, people have to understand.
Story.
Yeah, the story. I think people have understood it. Like, you've seen that's the part of the market where you've seen traditional buyers actually enter. And, you know, you have people like, you know, Alan Howard buying Fidenzas and Ringers and all that kind, yeah, of stuff. And, you know, I think that's really interesting. But it's really hard. Like, how would you, let's say you're someone who is not like a whale. You don't have 100, you don't have 85 ETH to go out there and buy a Fidenza. But right, let's say you have like, I don't know, like half an ETH, one ETH, whatever to go out there. Like, mm-hmm, what collections within Art Blocks do you think are interesting from that perspective? Because I think that's the counter argument I've always had. It's like, not everyone can go out there and buy a Fidenza or an Autobiff, right, for a Ringer. But there, yeah, are lots of like lower price collections. Yeah. So it's a difficult, yeah, thing to actually act on, I think, for people trying to put that on.
Yeah. I mean, if you're looking at it purely from an investment point of view, it's kind of like, there's just inherently going to be a lot more risk buying something at half an ETH because the market has already priced in a lot of this and said, these are the things that we value and we think will have long-term value. And that's why they're already up at 10 ETH. Like, the time to buy a squiggle at under half an ETH was 2021 and things like that. If you, let's say you do have half an ETH or an ETH in burning a hole in your pocket and you want to buy some generative art, I think it is kind of difficult to sort of flip that and turn that like 10x that in any sort of short time frame without getting lucky. So I wouldn't necessarily look at it through that lens. I would think, buy things you actually genuinely like, think are cool, want to hold, and just you'll have some exposure to it. Potentially financially it will do well in the long term. But yeah, it's like, it's not, again, it's not 2021 anymore. You're not minting some or buying anything for half an ETH. That's, unless you get lucky or do a lot of research and, you know, one in 100 might still 10x, 100x. But yeah, it's just difficult to go in with that approach. I mean, I think it's the same for most other things. Like, you have half an ETH and you're trying to find PFP projects or anything else to like flip up. It's really difficult now. And you kind of have to go a lot more niche and obscure, and maybe there's like opportunities on like Polygon now, or like, you know, Bitcoin Ordinals, or like the other chains and layer twos and things like that, where there's more like, as the friction increases, the like the potential for rewards increase, because like it just filters out a lot of people who just aren't going to be using it. There's no bots and things like that. So yeah, with one ETH to buy a generative art, I don't think from an investment point of view you're likely to find any crazy returns at the moment.
What do you make of Ordinals?
I spent like the last 6 weeks kind of digging into them a bit more. I think that they're exciting, and I think that they're interesting, and I think that they will stick around, and like there's enough of a narrative. Like all this stuff's about narratives, right? It's like they're valuable if people think that they're valuable, and if people continue to think and say that they're valuable, and if they can convince other people that they're valuable. And I think with Ordinals, there's enough of that community already around it that I think it will grow and it will be sustainable. So I think that there is value in Ordinals, and there will continue to be value in Ordinals. And inherently, it's just really cool to be able to have art on chain on Bitcoin. Like, that is just cool. And art, I think, is the only real big use case for Ordinals. Like, I don't think it makes any, there's no smart contracts. I don't think it makes any sense for like 99% of what NFTs can do. And that's why ETH is going to be the biggest place for NFTs. But I think if you think of like Bitcoin as a canvas and Ethereum as a canvas and these as canvases, I think it's a great canvas to create on. And maybe something will happen in the long term. I think, people who just dismiss it, I think out of hand, I think I'm missing a big part of it.
I think I agree with that. I think where I get lost is where people talk about this like Cambrian explosion for Bitcoin, where it's going to then push out like massive functionality for Bitcoin. I think there are just a lot of things that need to be sorted before that can really happen. But I can see the idea, like there is a beauty to like being able to do that for the Bitcoin community, like having it inscribed on different Bitcoin. I think people just like that as a concept. Like you said, it's just a narrative which sounds cool. Yeah. And it's just, the issue is that the Bitcoin community seems to always feel like it has the moral superiority. Like it's like, yes, it always has this like air about it. And so there was this idea that Ordinals would also have the air about it. But actually, when you get into Ordinals, it's just a bunch of like copied IP, or just like it's all the trash people is happening again. So
yeah,
it doesn't really have that like, oh my god, this is such a like a perfect collection, in the same way that in some ways like CryptoPunks were, or like Rare Pepes were. Like there's some real provenance to that. It didn't feel like they missed what was an incredible opportunity to do some really cool stuff in those early Ordinals. And they ended up doing a bunch of like punk derivatives.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that just because like all of the history of NFTs on ETH had already happened by the time Ordinals became a thing, people just were like, oh yeah, let's just, they all the inspiration came from the things that had already happened. And so there wasn't that slow or like as slow and organic like thing that just popped up like CryptoPunks, where oh yeah, for years people thought they were worthless and they took all, like people didn't want to pay the gas to mint them. With Ordinals, it was like already the narrative was, oh, you got to get one under 1,000, under 10,000, we got to pump these up, these are the valuable, and it was just like immediately a financial instrument, and like didn't really have that time for the art culture to really cultivate. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure they'll still do fine and be a thing, but it's just, it's a shame.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about generative art. Like, and also you talking about OV, I'm like a little bit more convinced about it. I agree that when I was walking past, because I was thinking about like, you know, maybe I live in Lisbon, doing some sort of a gallery here, and then you know the first question you ask if you open up a gallery is like, why is this just not a physical? Like, why is this better? Like, why do I have to have a TV in my house? Like, and yet the idea that it has to be created on chain, I think is a really good answer for that. That being said, I do think it's going to remain niche. I don't think generative art becomes a like that big an art movement. I think it still stays a relatively niche, but I think it can be still a very valuable one. I just don't think it becomes like the whole art market. Like,
isn't it the best way to display these things on prints anyway? From what people are saying.
Some of the
art, look good. I mean, yeah.
Some of the finances look good, but like the actual reason was like, why does it even have to be on chain? There is a reason for it to be on chain, which I think is slightly different. Even though, yeah, I agree. A Fidenza probably is a painting they do look pretty good.
Yeah.
I think Reckon Meridians look pretty good as a painting too. But yeah, I can see that argument as one that stands the test of time, but I just don't know if there's enough for everyone to kind of like pile into it. I think we're waiting there. So maybe let's go back to you as a trader. We also try and focus on like risk takers here. Like,
oh yeah,
how did you look at stuff at the start? Like, you obviously had a background in poker. How did you think about building a portfolio? How did you think about some of those trades? You said you had some skills from being a poker player, but maybe let's break that down slightly. Like, how in your life do you look at risk, and how has that benefited you over the last few years?
I mean, I guess every sort of decision you make is a risk to some extent or another. And every decision you make has a series of potential consequences or outcomes. And sometimes it could be like 99.999%. And then it's like, you don't even think about it. But most times you're actually thinking about a decision is because there's a reasonable chance it can go at least one of two ways, if not more. And I mean, I'm sure you know the concept of like probabilistic thinking, where it's like, all right, so if I buy this, then, you know, there's these four different outcomes, and one of them, you know, 10% of the time I lose all my money, 20% of the time, you know, I lose a little bit, 20% of the time I break even, 50% of the time I 5x. And you just like, it's like a math problem that you put together, and you're like, all right, that's a thing that I'm just going to buy, because based on my, like, all the information I've gathered and put into like this sort of equation, it's a profitable trade. It's like, it's a trade that if I ran it like in any isolated incident, I could lose all my money. But if I ran it 1,000 times, the graph would go up. And so that is kind of the mentality that I've had through life and through trading and everything like that. And then I think like bankroll management is like particularly one that poker really instilled in me. Because in the early days of poker, you wanted to move up in stakes as quickly as you could, because you could just make more money playing higher stakes. And the games weren't necessarily that much more difficult. Sometimes it was even easier to play the higher stakes games than the lower stakes games. But if you moved up and just lost all your money, then you like the opportunity cost gets you all the way back to zero. And so you need to like balance that and like think about how much money you have to invest in certain things and make sure to take profits to cover your expense or like along the way. And so like up locks, again, bringing it back to that, when I was getting in, like you'd mint and then immediately you could sell for like a 4 or 5x. And I was always like immediately selling, even though there was obviously some chance that they would continue running up. I couldn't take the risk that it would go to like down below mint and then I'll be out a bunch of money and not be able to take like more opportunities. So it was just like constantly piggybacking and growing that bankroll and managing it. And I think that's something that more people are aware of now, but I think a lot of people in 2021 maybe missed out on a lot of opportunities because they, like, you know, they bought, let's say, one Bored Ape. And like, let's say you had one ETH and you saw Bored Apes at one ETH, and that was like all your bankroll, and they go to 5 ETH or 6 ETH. And obviously the Bored Apes have performed tremendously well, but in that time, the summer of 2021, could you have taken that 6 ETH and like flipped it and invested in like 10 other things that you could also 10X and then 10X and 10X and just keep compounding? And I think that a lot of people don't have the tolerance towards risk and are willing to like sell something that they have a lot of confidence in to like bet on themselves and be like, oh, I can trade this into, you know, multiple other ways. Whereas I just have that higher risk tolerance and like ability to like, yeah, okay, let's risk it and see where it goes.
Yeah, I think it makes you very objective, which kind of gets rid of a lot of the bullshit reasons why you tell yourself you haven't sold the JPEG. Like, it makes you very objective about that sort of stuff, which massively helps. And the bankroll stuff, I think, is important too. Like, it's interesting what you said, like the stakes become easier in the high games. I think that's kind of the conversation you just had with Obi as well. Like the stakes become easier when you can buy a Fidenza because it's just easier, right? Like, it's much easier to play games when you get up to that level.
Yeah,
you can kind of sit back and hopefully that they're going to, the whole value will go up better. So I think that is an important one. Like, once you take profits, because it's once you get to those higher stakes games, they're just so much easier to play.
The opportunities are crazy. I think the psychological element is another huge part of it, where at poker 15 years is like, I'm used to playing tournaments and getting it in and like really, really good getting, and then just like losing and just like, oh, that sucks, and like that happens over you about it. I'm used to playing cash games for a month and losing money like every single day, and then you like question yourself and your sanity, and you're like, am I playing well, am I bad, am I just a losing player, has the last 5 years just been lucky and I'm now a terrible player? Like, you quit all these things, and like, you have to really dig deep and like find that confidence and that objectivity again to be like, you know what, I'm making good decisions. You ask your friends, you tell them at the hand you played, you get analysis, and like, yeah, okay, you're playing well, you're just getting unlucky. And so you get really used to like getting unlucky over and over and over and over again. And so like in the NFT space, you're going to get rugged, you're going to get buy scams, there's all these things that are going to happen that you're going to lose a bunch of money. And I think a lot of people who don't have that poker or like, you know, your backgrounds in trading where you can also lose a bunch of money, that coming from a background that's not like that, it tends to get to people a lot more like it got to me in the early days of poker. And so like the psychological element, I think, is kind of huge.
I know you're a kind of an angel investor now as well. I think it's part of your project. You also help with project advisory, but any tips there? I think some people even look at some of these private equity deals or like angel deals. Like, where have you been successful there? Because I know that's a large bit of what you did over the last 12, 18
I'm an angel in, angel invested, but like I'm not an angel investor in that. Like, I have no idea what I'm like. I got people started asking me in like 2021, do you want to invest in my company? I was like, oh, I got some money there, sure, I'll take 5,000, 10,000, 20, whatever. And like, yeah, I'll just like spray and pray. I was like, I'll take the same approach to NFTs. Now, having like, you know, got my own company and been building for a year and a half, I ask way better questions now. In the early days, I was like, oh, that's a cool idea. Yeah, have some money and like, let's see where it goes. Now I'm like, all right, you ask all the real questions about product market fit. How are you going to make revenue? What's your runway? Who are you and your team and all that kind of stuff. So I'm way more picky now about what I would invest in. I am an angel, but I don't really invest that much these days. I think it was just bull market mania, you know, that led me to invest in a bunch. And like, it worked out overall. I think the whole thing with angel investing is, and investing in general and things like that, is you make a whole bunch of bets and it's like 80, 90% will go to zero and like one or two might pay for the rest and then some, and you really hope for those big potential paydays. And I was fortunate to have a couple of those. So
yeah, I think the spray and play is kind of what you have to do in that space.
Yeah.
Like, there's just no... I mean, particularly back then, there was just so many different narratives.
Oh, it was wild.
Never knew what was going to hit.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing how when you talk about angel investing and being a seed round, all this kind of stuff, to the outsider, and this is what I used to think before I did like my first investments, to the outsider, it sounds like this great big thing where like loads of due diligence is done. You like have a lot of phone calls and, you know, you make this like carefully constructive view and decision. Then you like, you know, transfer money. It's like, it's not like that at all. Someone literally calls you and is like, hey, you're transfer money. Because like, yeah, here's 10 grand. You just sign some random documents and then you're done. That's it.
Yeah. That's exactly how it is.
I think that's even at VC level, man. Like, I actually think that's
VC level. That's how you,
for sure.
All you need is a lead, one person, and then everyone's just like, yeah, fuck it, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Like that person, if these other people are in, they did the due diligence, I don't have to do it, they did it.
Yeah. The due diligence spiral right there.
It's fucking hilarious. But I actually think the level of analysis that goes through is minimal to a lot of these. I think it's more a feeling thing, and I think that's kind of the unwritten rule of the whole sector.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So... You said you run a business. I saw the other day you employed like dozens of people. Like, what are you up to at the moment? Like, I know you obviously have your own like community, but you employ a lot of people. So yeah, what are you up to day in, day out?
So at our peak, I think we had about 20, which is like 6 full time and then like a bit over a dozen part time. We recently went through like scale cutbacks and we had to scale back bear market things and probably overhired during the bull and got zealous. So now it's like 4 of us full time and like another half a dozen in a part time capacity. And really, it's like, you know, we have an NFT membership community like, you know, you guys have as well. And it's like, that's the business. And we're figuring out how to make it work and how to generate revenue and how to keep the community happy and all that kind of stuff. And it was launched like November 2021 with the idea being that I was like creating content. I was doing like, I had a newsletter, I had these daily spreadsheets and was like writing all this stuff. And it seemed to like resonate with the community. And I was like, is there something that like, is there value here that we can create a community out of people that like this kind of content and analysis? And so we just launched a membership token and there was like, I said, no roadmap from the beginning and we're just going to like see where this takes us. And so over the last like 18 months, it's been a lot of trial and error and experimenting things. And I mean, I like our core thesis is like creating great educational content. and courses and guides and like helping people learn in like, there's so much crap out there in terms of like content, and just having like a trusted place you can go to consume content, as well as like meet other people in the space who are like not going to scam you, or not going to rug you, or not going to mislead you. That's I think where the value comes. So yeah, it's been like a wild ride over the last 18 months, and we've got this massive community now where like we put out a whole bunch. We did this email free course, and we had like 15,000 people sign up, just like onboard them into like NFTs as a rule, which is like way more people than I ever thought we would get in this kind of market. But yeah, like that's my day to day. It's like, how can we create good educational content? And how do we have to like pivot? Because it used to be a lot about onboarding, and now I no longer believe in onboarding that much. I don't like when we go mainstream, whenever that is, like people won't need to be, no one needs to be onboarded to use an iPhone or a MacBook or the internet or a website or email. It's like, it's just technology. So it's like, all right, how can we educate maybe builders on how they can use the technology to build cool things and build the products that users, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, that's like my day-to-day is like thinking and creating content mostly.
Do you have, what are your main like takeaways over the last couple of years doing that? I mean, we've obviously the business models has also like completely changed, like trading fees don't really happen, and it's a slightly different role. So like, that's not just for us, like what you just said, it's, you kind of have a lean team. It sounds like more lean now, and you can flex in and out, but do you think there is still business models for some of these bigger teams? Like how do you see businesses being spun up in Web3 now?
I mean, I think it's very difficult. I think that the, like, if I go back to like 2020, I had this conversation earlier today as well, whereas like, I would probably not have launched an NFT. I would have done like a paid monthly thing that everyone else in the world does for content. It's like, it paid $29 a month and you get access. And like that, it just makes sense. But because I was knee deep in NFTs, like, all right, let's try the NFT model and see if it works. And I think back then we all believed, or like a lot of us believed, royalties were like, oh, they're a thing. And then 6-8 months later, you're like, oh, actually, we're actually going to get to zero eventually. So we need to think about other models. So like for us, we're actually going back to like the basics, where it's like, all right, now we'll create courses and we'll charge for the courses, whether it's, you know, a standoff, $100-$200 for a course, or $20-$30 a month. And, you know, put them out to the world to generate revenue and give them to our community, either free or discounted, depending on where they are in the community. Because that's a sustainable business model again, and we need that. And so that's for us what's going to work. And I feel really good about it now, because like we have a very clear path to like positive. We're pretty close to breaking even, and pretty clear path to like positive revenue in the next couple of months. Some of the other communities where it's like the IP brand route, I think it's much more difficult, because it's very, I mean, Pudgy Penguins, I think, are doing an excellent job. They cracked the nut, and like they've got products out there in the real world that people actually like and will buy and pay for. But I think a lot of the other ones are going to struggle and probably not make it, even though they have a lot of money. It's really, really, really hard to build an IP brand that the world likes, or like enough people like. So yeah, I think we have a lot more pain coming for a lot of projects out there.
It's a funny if Luke and Nets was like, today, before Pudgy Penguins, he was like, today I'm going to wake up and build like a toy company, or today I'm going to build like a drinks company, or whatever it is, like, and then I'm going to start creating that IP that way. It's a really hard thing to do. It's a really hard thing to do like a Web2 idea and then build the IP from that. And something that I think people have realized, like, you know, for better or for worse, people were able to create a lot of IP through Web3 and through NFTs. And then it's like, how do you then make the right decision to monetize that IP? And I think with Pudgy Penguins, they did the right thing. They were like, okay, we had this IP that we've built through Web3. Now we have a brand that we can go out there and sell like Web2 goods or physical goods, whatever it is, in a market where there is demand. I think that was a smart transition. Yuga Labs maybe is another example. It's still, we'll find out the answer to that. But like, okay, we had this great IP and great following, great brand. Now let's go into like online gaming and see if we can, you know, crack that. And that's obviously a much taller order. But you know, the guy's like, oh, we had this IP and we're just going to keep selling you more of this IP through NFTs. I think they kind of got it wrong. It's like, well, you had this great IP, you had this great brand, but now you've just massively diluted it, rather than taking what you had that was special and you applying it to something different, which is what I think Luca recognized and did really well, to his credit. And, you know, maybe D-Gods are doing something similar, and, you know, we'll see how it ends up with Yuga and Apes, etc. But, you know, it's what I would personally say is, like, if you're someone who wants to create, you know, like toys or like clothing company or whatever it is, I'd probably build a community through Web3 first, because that's easy to do without offering any promises, without offering any roadmap, and then go and do that, because that will give you that leg up in like building a brand, building IP, building a community that I think people really, really struggle with in the like traditional world, I would say.
Yeah, Kickstarter, you're like 1,000 true fans or 5,000 hold, like they're compelled and incentivized to spread the word and want you to succeed.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm still scared about the future of a lot of these. I mean, like you said, we kind of run it lean, even our own organization, like, and we have various different diversified revenue streams that we were able to keep people on. But like, I sit there and go, like, if you're just building IP and you've probably hired dozens of people across various different salaries, and you're just like, they're just going to go. Like, there's no revenue for any of them. Like, the revenue.
I've heard from some of these companies as well. They have like high six-figure burn rates, sometimes seven-figure monthly burn rates, just because of how many people they have. And sure, maybe they raise $10 million, $20 million, but like that'll disappear quickly at that kind of rate.
Yeah. And it's not like the broader PE environment is that great even right now. So I still think there's a lot of pain to come in that space, which is why I kind of agree with you. Some of this, if you want to just play safe bets over the next couple of years, I think NFTs, you're probably looking at some of the generative art stuff. And it's unfortunate because it's not really that inclusive as an investment when they're at 50 ETH. And there's not, it's very, because I still think it would be niche. I don't think you can just buy new things and hope that becomes niche as well.
I mean, I guess like my sort of advice, it is difficult and like not everyone can do it, even like, but I would say like a squiggle is like 9-10 ETH. Maybe get some friends together and chip in like an ETH or two ETH each. And then like, that's a way to get some exposure to something that is, to me, is like one of the safest bets. Like if squiggles kind of fail, it's almost like it's so much. People say if Bored Apes fail, NFTs fail. That's not true. But if squiggles fail, it's just to me like the entire generative art movement, which is a massive, massive movement, is also, I just see that as such an unlikely event. So yeah, that's like what I tell friends as well, where they're like, I have like 5,000 to spend. I'm like, well, you could take a risk and buy these, you know, few different things, or find some friends and chip in and try and get something together.
It's one thing that I've been surprised about, because the PFPs are still like 60-70% of the market cap, including punks. But like, what has surprised me is how badly the sell-off has been in that space. And yet I thought that would seep in way more into the generative art stuff. And the generative art stuff has just kind of held its level. Like, some of it's up, but I thought everything would get decimated if PFPs
move. I think it's different pools of liquidity almost. Like, just there's some overlap, of course, but there's a lot of different groups of people that will buy PFPs and trade PFPs versus the generative art. And if we look back over the last 2 years, like, I remember January 22, PFPs had like this kind of bull run where it was like this, you know, this little spike at the start of the year, but generative art was still tanking. And it was like, there's been instances where they're very uncorrelated. And I think that's probably because there's just not that much overlap. And yes, there are still NFTs and there's some correlation in liquidity, but there's people with very deep pockets that love generative art and will never touch PFPs. And so there's like this liquidity that's just in a different ecosystem, I think.
Yeah, it's harder to commoditize too, the generative art probably. Whereas the PFPs, you can get people just trading the traits and whatnot, where that's harder to extrapolate and how liquid they can get with that.
So we should probably go into some of our closing questions. I think the first one, and maybe even related, is like, what have been your biggest, what was your biggest loss in the space, and maybe how you kind of bounce back from it? Or, and that could be across being a project founder, that could be across maybe even back when you were a poker player, but like, yeah, how you think about stuff like mentally, and how have you bounced back from
failure? So biggest one I would say would be when we launched Zen Academy in November 2021. I launched two projects at the same time, or two like tiers within the membership, and one was the Genesis base tier of It was an open edition for 2 weeks in ERC 1155, and it was like 0.033 ETH, very accessible at that time. A lot of people could mint, but I also had a more expensive, more exclusive offer at for 333 people called the 333 Club, and that was at 3.3 ETH. And so the idea behind minting them was that I was doing advising consulting, and I had like literally like 100 people reach out to me in the course of a week, asking me to like advise or consult for them. And I was like, well, this is obviously impossible. What if I like create an NFT that you can get access to a community where I can offer some advice and time and help you on like a more intimate hand-to-hand, like one-to-one basis, but it's not like I'm full on advising. And I let me try this out. I put out like an application form because I said, all right, if you're interested in this, fill out this form. I'll get an idea of numbers and I can almost like go through and select people as well. If you're here just to flip or trade or like use my name or something like that, I can maybe try and weed you out. And there were like 1500 applications. It's like in the course of like a month, 1500 people applied to mint this thing at 3.3 ETH. And I was like, all right, that's cool. Great. Let's select people. And all right, this seems like it's going to be a good thing. Let's go to launch and we'll do that. And it was Zen Academy. And I did it. And then like the day of mint opens and I announced the mint and like two people mint. And then I'm like, oh, something went wrong here. There's like a mismatch of communication or expectations. And that was just like a kick to the gut where I was like, huh, I thought that there was all this demand because 1500 people applied and all that kind of stuff. And then like, there was a bunch of mistakes where I didn't like communicate it properly. And I was terrible at marketing and I didn't like do anything for anything like that. And so over the course of a few months, I like reached out to the people that had applied and DM'd them and just wanted to check in. And it was a slow thing, but like it minted out over the course of about 4 to 5 months. But that initial day, I remember just feeling like I got punched in the gut. And I was like, all right, I was like on the couch in like the fetal position for a few hours. And then I was like, all right, let's get up and do stuff. And just started DMing people and sort of came back from that. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like you had a good bounce back from that at least.
Yeah.
Easy.
Yeah. It worked out. Yeah.
So with our final question, while we wrap this up before we get into loot box spins, we always ask the guests, what's your best advice for the audience on how not to get wrecked? So what do you got there for us?
I mean, my advice to everyone is just be patient. It's not specific, but it's like, it's so easy and tempting to like FOMO and rush into things in this space. No matter where you are in your journey, if you're just starting out, it can be very tempting. Even now, like someone DM, like a friend DMs you, he's like, hey, check this out. It's like, all right. My first reaction is, oh yeah, that's a friend I trust. Let me just mint some. But it's like, you do that often enough, and especially in this market, you just end up accumulating junk and getting wrecked. So be patient is like the first thing that came to mind. And I think just like be way more skeptical than like everyone has an agenda. Everyone is trying to make money basically and off you somehow. So if there's a project that just trying to make money, if someone's sending you a link, then they want usually like maybe you have a handful of friends that are not like this, but most people in a Discord server, anywhere in an alpha group, they're all trying to pump their own bags. Anyone on Twitter is talking about everyone else has an agenda, and just like remember that and keep that at the front of your mind and think about like have your own strategy and stick to it. And that comes back to like bankroll management and things like that. But yeah.
Perfect. Yeah, man. No, that's everyone. So it says a similar derivative of that. So the keys to the success are discipline, patience.
Yeah.
You know, keep going when you lose and all that, whatnot.